This is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress. I'm Grace Cavalieri. Today we're featuring four women poets from the Washington area, and they are very different. Each one is different from the other, but each is making a permanent indentation on American letters. This is our 30th consecutive year on air for The Poet and the Poem, and no better way to celebrate than with Moira Egan, who's a poet and who actually started listening to my program when she was a little girl, sitting on her daddy's lap, Michael Egan, the very great poet.
Thank you.
So it's a pleasure to have you here and to hear an opening poem.
Thanks, Grace. I'm really happy to be here. I believe in a muse, and so I usually begin with an invocation to her. To my muse upon her return. Oh, muse, sweet red jazz juice, feather boa attitude, where have you been? A mystery to me, your sporadic telegraphy, and how to please thee. Now, down on my knees, most supple supplication, I offer you the keys to my place. Tell me, what do I do to entice you to stay and play nice? In my house I keep no ice, I tend to fire. Blue sparks along coiled electric wires and the slow smoke incense of desire. Is that it? Like love, it's only chemical, a perfect fit of molecules, one into the other, sweetly nestled. Big hands in the small of my back, a kiss so luscious the room turns black, and the ticking of the clock for a moment stills. You come and go regardless of will. Tears, libations, heart, what shall I spill to keep you here with me? You who make love in normal people and in me. Poetry.
Moira Egan, is that from your book, Cleave?
Yes, it is.
It is. And that was nominated for the National Book Award and was a finalist for the Forward Book of the Year Award. And Moira was chosen by James Merrill originally for the Austin Prize, and then we began her career. And so now we are on her career, and we're going to hear more of it. Here's Moira.
I do this odd thing in that I write a lot of formal work, and so I thought, other than the muse poem, perhaps I would go into a stream of sonnets. And since Grace mentioned my father, Michael Egan, who was a poet, and were clearly, I don't know if it was nature or nurture, but here I am, I wrote a sonnet for him actually just before he died, just a couple of days before he died, and I'll read that. Vespers. One of the gifts of the evening hours is darkness, a velvet screen between yourself and the brutal art of dying. Your knees and shoulders, ribs, are hard-etched in the parchment of your skin. You watch your own heart beat, you've grown so thin. Another gift is numb, narcotic sleep. Entire days drip slowly into veins, the tubes exchanging morphine for release from pain as deep and venomous as dreams. Tonight I wish you this, a candle blown out gently, the last page of your book, and all your children near. And may your bones sing no longer with pain, but with roses.
Did he know you were going to be a poet?
That was a long struggle. I was a poet when I was a little kid. And then during the adolescent rebellion, I, of course, decided that I should study economics and political science at
college.
Oh,
now that doesn't sound so rebellious in this society.
That was the paradoxical thing. I was rebelling away from a household of poetry, but I obviously found my way back eventually. He was, at the end, he actually died while I was in graduate school at Columbia. But he did know that things were going reasonably well, and, you know, I sometimes think, well, he must be looking down smiling at me, or at least I hope he is.
We know he is. Moira Egan, I'm Grace Cavalieri. We're at the Library of Congress.
The other scary little fact about my life is that I teach high school, and so there's a lot that I keep from my students, obviously, because I love my job, and it's interesting to have that kind of a private life that you at least in theory write about in your poems, and how much do you want your children to know, your student children, that is. So I stole some end rhymes from Shakespeare's When My Love Says That She Is Made of Truth, I Do Believe Her, Though I Know She Lies, that sonnet. And I wrote a poem which I often read to my students to convince them that I am very fond of them. And this is called a bout rime. It's a little game with the end rhymes from another poem. Again, a sonnet. Though poets lie in service of the truth, and fiction's simply truth tricked out in lies, what do I tell my students, whose sweet youth does not allow for gritty subtleties, that I commit the crimes of one still young and too immortal to obey what's best for organs such as liver, heart, and tongue? I keep my wild hair storybox suppressed. I love my kids, and though I feel unjust, I hope they'll understand me when they're old enough to see that love's a blinding trust that lives or doesn't once the lie's been told. Therefore, I lie to them so I can be a part of them and yet hold on to me.
Oh, that is beautiful,
Thank
Mara.
You.
That is beautiful. And that shows all of your past training in metrics as well as your high dazzle.
Thank you.
If you are a contemporary poet, mm-hmm. and you are considered a contemporary poet by virtue of age and quality, what is it exactly in your poem that makes it contemporary, quote-unquote, poetry?
Mm-hmm. Well, not all poets write in form these days. I think that there's a kind of resurgence of it, and an almost acceptable resurgence of it. And so I really do pay attention to old-fashioned forms such as sonnets, but I write about more questionable subject matter, love, death, sex, rock and roll, things like that, that traditionally, well, love, of course, was, but speaking from a female perspective and in a female voice, speaking to those experiences in form, I think, is something that Edna St. Vincent Millay did it, and then it was that ball was dropped for a long time.
Mm,
so I think that
right.
that's, and it's one of the reasons I like being a poet, is that you can play with the tension between the form and the content of the poem.
And so you say some tough things.
Uh-huh.
Let's hear it. Here's Moira, and she's known for her subject matter, her content in exquisite craft.
Another sonnet. This one about falling in love. Not that I know about that. Vertiginous. I walked into the sunset by mistake, forgetting work and love, even this heat. Amazing how the scarlet on the lake spreads out like virgin blood upon a sheet hung out the next day, wind-whipped, trophy-proud. And later, as the haze rolls in, the gray of lake embraces sky, a ghosty shroud. That heron's blue, the color of your eyes, his awkward, stalky flapping into flight, are metaphors as fitting as the night we fumbled, won the flesh, into a bed unknown, unmade, unmaking, flesh and blood, the fabric all we are. This feels, you said, like vertigo or falling into love.
Mm. You have a poem not unlike that on Innisfree,
mm-hmm.
Poetry.org,
mm-hmm.
and it was Abad,
mm-hmm.
yeah, so that you have some themes that are very powerful in that line. See, I'm on to you, Moira.
Well, you are indeed.
Don't try to hide.
Well.
So we'll
well, how can we hide?
That's really right. And you
yeah.
put it out, we hope that 1,000 million people will read you.
I hope so, too.
This is from the book Cleave.
Yes. This is not a sonnet. Let's do something slightly different. It's written in terza rima, Dante's form. So, of course, we think of hell. And, well, you realize I'm being a little bit arch here. I mean, I do know about falling in love and actually have done it recently, which is pretty nice. So this is a poem taking imagery from rock climbing, actually, because my brother is a climber. And, you know, that stuff was always in his apartment, so I got used to looking at it. But it'll be fairly obvious. Cliffhanger. So here we stand at the famous precipice. Yes, I'm shivering. No, it's not the cold. My palms are sweaty. I'm little girl nervous. This handed-down equipment's pretty old. The buckles on my harness are rusty. I never believed the old man who sold me these goods. I've never been good at trusting any one or thing into which I've placed my heart, my hand. Precipitous is the wrong word, my dictionary says. But it works for me, dangerous and steep and fast, and one more look at your dear face looking back at me, eyes serious and deep with what looks so like love, I have to say, take my hand, this isn't falling, it's a leap. Another one, I'll read the title poem from the collection, actually, which was my brief foray into something like language poetry, but very brief.
Just to start with Cleave.
Yes.
To tell us about that.
Yes. The word cleave has not only the obvious definition of to cut apart rather fiercely, but also to adhere, to stick to someone. So it's its own antonym. And there are a number of other sort of sub-definitions, such as to find your way through a path, underbrush kind of thing, to split or fissure. And so the nice thing, the unifying principle of this book is the different definitions of the word cleave, because otherwise how was I going to get that stuff together? And when you split the word cleave, it splits into interesting words itself. So that was the impetus for this poem. Cleave. If I hand you this flower, if I flower in your hand, is it hibiscus? Do you hear biscuit or ruby lipped hiss? The sign says open. The sign says close. Learn mouth for me and cleave. Cleave to adhere firmly and closely or loyally and unwaveringly. Cleave, see leave, to divide by or as if by a cutting blow. Mild white milk from the green stem. I snip the blossom cleanly as I slice the past from the future, the present a slightly rusty blade. The present is a blade, belayed.
You are truly a poet. There's no way you're going to be an economist. No way.
No.
You can't break economy into that many syllables.
No, you cannot.
No. Continue with us, please. Moira Egan. She's also president of the Washington Writers Publishing House. So service to poetry and writing poetry take up the full day.
I'll read another sonnet that's actually an Ars Poetica. It's about the where poems come from. And I thought, I've always been interested in pearls. And I thought that they make such a lovely metaphor, not just for poetry, but for making art. Ars Poetica, Etiology of Pearl. Observe the salt-sweet tissue of this pith, its tenderness so aphrodisiac that penetration could be dangerous. It wraps itself in layers of rough shellac. But even such strong armor has its chinks through which might enter minuscule a grain of sand or sad that's sharper than one thinks. Then nacre's slow embrace encloses pain. To test a pearl, rub gently on your teeth. The real ones aren't smooth. They're slightly rough and gritty, like adultery or truth. Wear them every day. The oils and stuff secreted by your skin will make them shine. And you know what they say about the swine.
You're known for your narratives also.
I guess a little bit.
Mm-hmm. So you think you can do it all?
No.
But what do you consider yourself, a lyric poet?
I think I do, mm-hmm. Yeah. And especially a formal lyric poet. And the I in the poems isn't always me, of course, and that's hard to convince the audience that that's true. Somehow we believe it more readily of novelists. But that I isn't always me. Or should I say that I isn't always I? But the formal aspect of things is really interesting me at this point. And I sort of feel scared and naked looking at a blank screen or sheet of paper. And until the moment comes at which the poem sort of figures out what its form is going to be. I think those are the best poems that I end up writing, is when the content and the form are working really closely together with each other.
But in the aesthetics of your own life, that's evident. So it's not surprising to me.
Smoke. If you were smoke, he said, you'd be the smoke that rages from a forest fire, close and wild and dangerous. Here ends the quote, but not the source of it, and me, morose, because I've always tried to be the smoke that billows gentle in the temple, joss or sandalwood, the incense that's the yoke to help us get to God. For me, the closest feeling to religion is the smoke my body gives off when it gets too close to someone else. And right back to the joke, I torch the temple by mistake, confess, my smoking gun is still my one desire for one who'll feed the flames and love my fire.
The program is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress. That was Moira Egan helping to celebrate 30 years on air. And I couldn't be happier.
Thank
you, Grace.
I'm Grace
Cavalieri. We're back, and this is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress, featuring four Washington area women who are making a difference, and I'm here to prove it. Ernie Wormwood is sitting with me, and she's going to read an opening poem.
Thank you, Grace. This first poem comes from a quote by Ralph Waldo Emerson, the title, "The man is only half himself, the other half is his expression." Driven from hearth and home by the appetite of the seeker for the sea, the poem set out to find itself, its place, its nightmare, its fable, the love of its life, its epigram, its pantomimous, villanelleness, Shakespearean and Petrarchian sonnetness, its Keats oatmeal, its Dante Beatrice, its Whitman mammoth, its reverent Rumi ribald. It searches academia, bars, cafes, poet's house, city lights, the Library of Congress, poetry at midnight, Mecca, the Louvre, the Serengeti, and finally descends into hell, rising on the third day. It can't face heaven, what if there is none? Takes a chance on the moon in all its gibbousness. Hello, the moon is full of luminous things, nonsense, mimsy, legend, has a metaphorical nose, eyes made of similes, similes made of smiles, and a tongue that says this. Home is where the hearth is. The poet is there in a purple velvet chair, holding a silver pen, barely touching the parchment, waiting to bestow grace and beauty, waiting to warm you, ready to bring you from the fire, ready to write you wild in the world, ready to let you go.
Ernie Wormwood. I'm Grace Cavalieri. She's a poet, teacher, mother, who lives in Leonardtown, Maryland, and she's been associated with the Squaw Valley Community of Writers and the Southampton Writers Conference for artistic support, something we all need. Here's another poem.
This is called The Woman Who Thought She Was the Moon. Got rounder and rounder, lost all her hair, started disappearing once a month, stayed out all night, slept all day. Didn't have to move to Barcelona. She was already there and also in Paris, Ho Chi Minh City, Fiji. Get the picture? She just put her lips together and blew. Thus came the wind in all its willows. Sometimes people misunderstood. Sometimes people understood. I am meant to be longed for. Give up that wishing on stars. At last, she arrived in the poetic city. Her hair grew back, on fire. She knew she was home and in her tribe. I am moon, she said.
And another, then we get a real good sample of you.
Okay, my father was so important to me, and this is a little poem I wrote about him. It's called, "We Are All Astronauts." Up on the lonely moonscape lie mementos the astronauts leave behind when they rocket back to Earth. Things for people they love, time capsules full of letters and notes and photographs inside of books inscribed to their wives or daughters, like this one is to me. The American Girl's Handbook with your daring handwriting inside. Love, Daddy, so big it's all across the title and everything. It looks like you have just written it and gone out for something. You'll be back in a few minutes with a Hershey bar for me. But this book about how to be a really good girl in America feels abandoned and bereft now, as if on a bookshelf in space, all alone in a library on the moon.
Ernie Wormwood, in her funny, sad voice, when I ask you, what are you searching for? Because there is such a yearning in your poems. What would you answer?
I would say that place that always feels like home, and that moves around in your life from point to point. It's not always the same place.
Is it in the poem? Do you find it in the poem?
Well, when I write poems, if I'm writing well, I get chills on my neck. like you do at other times. So sometimes, yes.
She's just blazing a path in many, many periodicals right now. Rain Tiger, Rhino, Beltway, Poetry Quarterly, Poetry Bay, a lot of online magazines.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where it's at, right?
Well, some of it.
I'm all for it.
Me too.
I absolutely think this is the 21st century itself. And she's in several anthologies, including a recent Voices Without Borders, and then another, Only the Sea Keeps. But most of all, here's Ernie.
Okay. This was the year a poem I wrote for Stanley Kunitz's 100th birthday. He died this year, and so it's called A Poem for Stanley and also for Lucille Clifton, friend of mine. When I grow up, I want to be Stanley Kunitz and wear sneaky tennis shoes wherever I want to wear them. Flirt and dance with words so longingly, they bloom in everyone's garden where I touch them and they remember me. I want to be Stanley, getting younger every year, especially at Dodge, telling about his index cards of meaningful, locked-in, circulating energy poems by Yeats, Blake, Hopkins, Hardy, that have no date, telling about the pastel portrait, about his ever-burning cheek, the lonely growing where he was a living taboo. So we know someone else has felt that way too, but still flowered into Stanley. I almost forgot. I want to sit next to Maxine Kumin on the poetry shelf. Stanley, this I promise. When I grow up to be you, I will celebrate your birthday on July 29th every year, maybe with Lucille. We will name you flower and gift and poet. Most of all, we will call out beloved for Stanley Jaspon Kunitz. Can you see us up on the roof of the red brick building at the foot of Green Street, waving to you?
Ernie Wormwood, I'm Grace Cavalieri, and I guess the greatest tradition for one poet is to honor another. And you do that in a lot of poems. We'll have another.
This poem just insisted on being written, and I put it down and took it up again several times. It's a poem in the voice of the girl with the pearl earring, painted by Vermeer, and it's called Girl with a Pearl Earring Speaks of Vermeer. It was the mystery he brought to me, and I to him, a wild tautness in the balance between painting and the abandon of the painter. So few he would allow in, already a wife and all the children. For us alone, ever the tension and the marriage of view. Though people thought it was the light I wore that anchored his desire, it was the shadow that rose and fell between us, the undiminished darkness of the pearl that was his purest reverie, and so he painted me. It was our only way.
Ernie Wormwood.
Seeing the three-legged fawn again after 15 months. She comes back all grown up. She has adjusted completely to her disability. She just turns up in the yard like she belongs here, wearing a crown she won at Miss Dear America for most regal over all the other four legs. Wearing the love of her same two companions, she is a loyal deer, demonstrating faith to me, looking up to me in the window as if to say, "See, you have to believe. You don't know everything." All these last months, I thought she was dead, but she was just away. She was just teaching me a lesson. Last time, she brought me a poem about the tsunami. I hated it because I thought the fawn would die, and I would never get over it, another grief, another X on my heart. This time, she is the hot news, the bright and beautiful rainforest of happiness, of returning, of reuniting, of believing that things can turn out, the wonder of a triumphant, glorious day after a hurricane. She stands for happy endings, redressing of grievances, dispensations, apologies, change, love, peace, and most of all for coming home to a place where the porch light is on, where we always love you, where we have missed you, been haunted by you, wished and wished for just one more day with you. My goosebumps at seeing her last and last. They break all goosebump records and in their joy rename themselves Dear Bumps. Imagine.
You are breaking goosebump records because there is a surprise in your voice. It is always fresh because you're always surprised at what you're saying. And the reader gets that. And so the reader has a sense of wonder all the time. And that is not perishable.
Ernie, that's Wormer. Good.
I think it's good. Ernie and Grace, a final poem.
Okay. This is a poem that uses a lot of lines from poets that I admire greatly, so it's a kind of homage.
In Italian, we call it cento. It's actually a form.
Sounds good. Okay. It's called Where Old Poems Go When They Retire, and it comes from the site www.poems.com, where every week they retire a certain number of poems. And I looked at that, and I thought, well, I wonder where they go when they retire. And so here's the poem. Where Old Poems Go When They Retire. They go to Kansas and click their heels, wishing they were home, but of course they can never get there again. The sonnets fly to Avignon to find Petrarch's Laura for an interview and at last get her side of the story. Some slip off to Stratford-upon-Avon to rest, where all losses are restored and sorrows ended. The odes take an old steamer to Chile to honor Neruda and are soon arrested. But they are crafty still and escape on Superman's cape to a poetry relocation program. Remarkable how they thought retirement would be full of Winnebagos and tailgate parties and the AARP for old poems. Some of the free verse, like Forgetfulness, land at Leisure World, where they try to remember the name of the author. Wasn't it Billy something? Whitman stops by, contradicting himself, talking about how large he is, as if they didn't know this already. A few curl up in the pool hall, being cool, being real cool. The haiku dance in the desert, where they find Basho with Elvis, playing a little golf, rocking in the way of elegance. Not a single one retires to Florida except that poem about order which catamarans to Key West. The last we know of, and we do not know all, crash at City Lights in San Francisco and celebrate 50 with Ferlinghetti and Ginsburg. They dream of Coney Island, of a supermarket in California, and howl at midnight. Like us, they seek significance. Remember them. Ever their words are wild. Ever their words are wild.
That's the voice of Ernie Wormwood. We're at the Library of Congress. This is The Poet and the Poem. At the Library of Congress, and we're back with Ann Becker, who is a prominent poet, who has been a radio producer, and who has a book which is compared to no other on Charles Darwin. Here's Ann in her own voice.
The Blessing. It was hunger that brought us together. First word we spoke to each other was lunch. It was summer, a foreign country. We stood at the threshold of adulthood, our flesh moist, eager, our ignorant hearts danced in our womanlike breasts. Out of the dirt, from the floor of the castle keep, we rose to eat what we gathered from the small shops of the cathedral town. Crisp, crusted bread, sharp, smooth cheese, globular tomatoes, red cheeks, unblemished skin, tender petals of pink meat. Everything we did to music, talk music, the body's own sostenuto when it loves color, buoyancy, salt. We floated in a fever of laughter, slept together, nestled like dogs all night, and let the rain pour over us.
That is the voice of Ann Becker. I'm Grace Cavalieri. Her poetry, fiction, and interviews have been all over the country. Antioch Review, Southern Poetry Review, Gargoyle, Washington Review, any number of them. She's been writing for years and years. Her prize-winning book is The Transmutation Notebooks, Poems in the Voices of Charles and Emma Darwin. And that was from 1996. And her new manuscript is Human Animal?
Human Animal.
Mm. Intersection of Science and the Arts. That is your signature. You come from a scientific family.
Well, my father was a researcher, a medical researcher. He was an immunologist. And so I grew up with science and the idea that, you know, just regular people can understand it and also can love it. You know, love that way of observing and understanding the world.
The way a poet observes.
Absolutely.
Even. Yes. Yeah. And you were teaching a poetry workshop called Writing the Body. So was that related in any way?
Well, actually, that workshop, which I'm teaching, it's a continuing workshop, is for people who've had experience with life-threatening and chronic illness as patient, caregiver, or family member, which to me is everyone in the world. But yes, it definitely came out of my working with science, also with my father's death when, he wouldn't say that he was dying, and his doctors would never say that he was dying, which I found very difficult. So,
Ann Becker is with us, and we're going to hear her in her own voice.
Well, in this next poem, I am going to read a poem from the Transmutation Notebooks. Most of them are long, so this is one of the few short ones. And the first poem that I read, The Blessing, is actually about young love, and it's from about 35 years ago with a friend that I met on an archaeological dig in England. And now this one is a poem of old married love. And it's in the voice of Charles Darwin. And it came out it's set at a time just before he published a book called Sexual Selection and the Descent of Man. And sexual selection was a sidelight to his theory of evolution by natural selection. And what it said was that in his mind, it was really the female that really chose sort of the traits of the male that she preferred. And so, you know, this explains why the male peacock has this incredible tail and those kinds of things. And you'll hear in it, you know, a lot of how he did his research. And I do mention Mrs. Cameron. I talk about her photographs. That's Margaret Julia Cameron, who was a famous Victorian photographer who took a very iconic picture of him. She did not do Emma Darwin, his wife, because she did not like to do old women. She liked to do old men, though. So this is his sexual selection. Today, I entered the great sub-kingdom of the vertebrata. All day I have studied fish, dissected them, read about them in books and journals, in letters from my expert correspondents who patiently answered all my detailed questions, compared male and female fish, wondering always what causes the differences between the sexes. I am mad with delight, having a whole new class of creatures to consider. At luncheon, I could hardly eat my soup for thinking of the feathery gills, pectoral fins, the hooked jaw of the male common salmon. Now at night, I lie in bed awake while Emma sleeps the good, well-earned sleep of the wife and mother. She snores softly and pictures a fish as accurate as Mrs. Cameron's photographs appear in my mind as if I dreamed awake. Mr. Warrington's loving estimation of the male stickle back, he says it is beautiful beyond description, returns to me, and Emma swims by, a gigantic pale fish, her scales shiny and wet, the quick flick of her fins as she swims off, smiling slightly at my enthusiasms. And I imagine myself a male fish. I dart around her in every direction and then back to the nest I have made for her. I return to her again. She continues her strong, steady, idle swimming, amused by my ardor. I push her with my snout, pull her by the tail and side spine. I am mad with delight. I will do anything. I am bright green and blue, belly and throat carmine. My scales are lustrous like metal, and I feel my skin translucent, thin, my fishy body slippery, aglow with an internal incandescence, as if my love resided hot in my simple heart, in my muscles, in all my organs, in my tail and fins, even in my bones, not merely in my mind. The thoughtless love for the female of my kind.
That soaring poem is so emblematic of you because the sound, the music, the sound is fantastic. I could have taken your S's and just gone to sleep with them. Mm-hmm. But also the color and the it's so vivid, but intricacy, detail, intricacy. You do the most difficult things in the poem one can do. You take a narrative and change it into a lyric, into an opera. In your own life, do you see that challenge for the difficult cropping up all the time? Always to do the thing, the most it can be done?
Well, one of the things that I'm really looking for are to make connections between and to see connections and to feel connections between things that are very far apart, that seem very far apart. So that is one of the things. And looking for patterns in maybe everyday and ordinary kinds of things. So it's a really a close looking, but as I say in another poem, it's actually more like listening, you know, that even when I'm using my eyes, that I'm listening, I'm not really looking.
Let us hear another poem.
Okay, and this is another. I'm the poems I'm reading all have to do with my concerns and my obsessions, and one of the things that is very much a part of who I am as a poet is that I am a teacher, and I teach adults, but I also teach children. I've taught children, you know, before they could write, up into adults, you know, in their 70s and 80s. And I am looking for connection, and I'm looking for the connection in my own life between my childhood and my adulthood, and the work that I do, especially with children, you know, helps me keep that kind of connection. And so, and when I work with, you know, even the youngest students, I really treat them as equals. And so this poem is called, I Spend My Days Among the Short People. I spend my days among the short people. Pilot or poet? To them it's so obvious, so easy. I'll try that, they say. I'll just do this. And I flit from miniature desk to miniature desk, pausing to look down at the scrawled pages. Enraged, says one. Spiritual storm, another proclaims, the swirling vortex. Together, we walk out into a silver-blue day. Watch snakes slip over powdery sand, stroke the soft, iridescent scoop of shell, recognize trash discarded by the sea. Debris, they name it confidently. And one of the smallest of these short people doesn't abandon me when all the others dash off to the next attraction and we are alone. I'm afraid of death, she says, her voice small in the big day. Short myself, still I am the taller person, so I feel it's my job to push death away. But the tumors keep coming back, she says, and shows me fine lines of scars on her small porcelain hand.
small in the big day. Ann Becker.
Yeah. And then this next poem is also, when I was talking about connection between my adulthood and my childhood, and with a group of students that I was working with, fifth graders, they had been doing Australian Aborigine art in their art classes, and so I wanted to do poems with them about the dream time. And so this is my own poem about the dream time. In the dream time, although a time without sleep, there being no work from which to rest. A tiny gorge, an abyss vast as a grass blade or a thorn, as if cut by fish or bird bone, first divided the world. A mighty trickle, slight torrent, seeped through this fissure, rushed slowly between velvet banks, blanketed by moss so fine, its filaments glowed translucent green, burning the raw color of spring. And there we were, dreaming, not sleeping, the first people, like ants, scuttling under mayflower, violet, squill. Engineers arranging earth grain by grain, our legs thin as whiskers, our arms antennae as if we were blind. Perhaps we were, most likely we were, but of course we didn't know it if we didn't know words for eyes, for sight. What we knew was color, the taste of color, the crisp, moist savor of blue, green's fresh bitterness, bright, spicy snap of red and yellow, pale yellow, almost ivory or pearl. It coated our lips like cream. And sienna, taste of clay, would become crust of bread, the soft summer night air, chocolate. But this was the time before bread, before chocolate, before cranberry, unctuous, sour, when dream time's larder stocked milk, bee juice, pulverized seeds, acorn cap baskets oozing vermilion fruit. We opened our mouths, our pink tongues wriggled like worms. The earth's food slithered down our purple throats, filled our bellies until we leaked, until we lay beached like overturned boats, hulls basking in the heat. And then we played. Water, our instrument, our toy. We drenched everything we touched, our green hose, no bigger than a straw, we sprayed. No longer blind, we watched rainbows cascade in drops against the sky, let the rain's cold kiss claim us as kin. Then the songs came, line after line. We reeled them out of our throats, the notes teaching us their tune, our tongues tasting words awake, and how ripe, golden, we did sing.
The voice of Ann Becker. This is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress. I'm Grace Cavalieri. We're back, and this is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress, featuring four Washington area women. And here's Lynn Lifshin, who is the author of The Licorice Daughter, My Year with Ruffian. Here's Lynn.
When I came back from hearing the news that the Preakness had had the terrible injury for Barbaro, I thought of my poem about Ruffian. On that day, it was as if she had wings. And then the wings turned to wax, were melting. There was a hush seconds after the wild cheers as Ruffian edged ahead. It was hot and the roses were dripping. The sun kept on, as it did, with Icarus following from the sky on melting wings. The birds didn't stop. When her jockey pulled her up that last night, everyone who knew must have covered their eyes.
That's Lynn Lifshin. She is also the author of a new book, Another Woman Who Looks Like Me, just published by Black Sparrow. And Lynn has written, this is no lie, She has written 120 published books of poetry. I would like to ask you how you started building this universe for Ruffian to occupy.
I started when I had a student many years ago around the time of Ruffian's last race in 1975 who said to me, she had MS, "I would never quit. I will run to the end. I'm like Ruffian." I had to know who Ruffian was.
Let's go with it. Lynn Lifshin, I'm Grace Cavalieri.
Before she had her name, she was Sophie, the big sofa, soul sister because she was black. No one seemed to know her name, dark mystery, midnight. No one knew if even the clockers knew. Speedball, beauty, the female, the freak. But one hot walker said she would be a stakes filly, name or no name. It was her stride, almost dreamlike, floating. Riders with a sense of pace were fooled. She was like a dancer with Balan hanging in the air, suspended. If you were on her, you thought the clockers were wrong. Sometimes it seemed she wasn't running, never came back winded. Those long legs seemed too long for a real horse. Someone said it was as if she hung there and the ground rushed under her.
This is from Texas Review Press, right?
Yes.
And was an award-winning book. And you have actually several of it. Before that, we have Before It's Light. That was around 2000. And you had In Mirrors before that. Upstate, an unfinished story. You have been published by almost every press in America.
Not every press.
Oh dear, we have to find that one and go to it. But right now we're talking about the Licorice Daughter, Ruffian, and you've given her immortality. But what is it with you and horses? I mean, were you ever even on one?
Well, I grew up in Vermont where everybody skied and rode horses. I did not ski. I took horseback riding lessons, just a little.
Well, I'm from Trenton, and I mean, I don't think I would recognize a horse, but I started loving horses when I read this book. I think that's as good a testimony as you're going to ever get. I really started loving horses, and you will too. Here's Lynn Lifshin. We're at the Library of Congress.
When I look at riders painting the racetrack, death on a pale horse, I see it reversed. Circling back, horses and death, the riderless horse at JFK's funeral, stirrups going backward. That May, Ruffian's maiden, the tattoo inside her lips still new. I imagine her muscles rippling on that 2-minute gallop to the gate, the blue air, her mane smelling faintly of soap and apples. Metal, silk, the gasp, thunder, then one black arrow whizzing past.
Are these chronological in her life, the way you segmented the book?
The book is segmented.
Mm-hmm. And did you do that for a story to tell the
yes,
plot?
Yes, I did. I did, to introduce first the poems that were just about horses in general and then about her birth.
Maybe when you read the next one, you'll give us a line which prompted that.
Well, here's a poem about her trainer, who is someone I was very, very impressed with and would love to meet. He's in his 90s, Frank Whiteley Jr. Watching that horse, as her trainer always called her on tape, I can see why they called her Wonder Lady. People who saw her said her walk was unique. No one didn't call her special. I keep going back to the opening shot of Belmont, hazy, mysterious early light, where Ruffian started and ended. Years later, her trainer's face is still full of love, and if he was a crying man, talking of her first and last day, he'd be sobbing.
I swear I think you love this book more than any other you've written.
I do.
It comes through.
I love Ruffian. I'd like to be buried with her.
Wow.
And I love her. I love her.
Let's have more love.
This is a poem about the first day when the horses are taken from their mothers. And both the mothers and the fillies are very scared and sad. Now the pastures are empty. The mares stand alone in their stalls. Those who've lost their foals for the first time paw the hay, sniff for something familiar. Moments before, the barn full of shrieks and neighing, a dark truck backfiring. Ruffian dug her tiny feet into the hay, tried to nuzzle her mare, her long legs black as the bones of cherry branches. She was born as the petals opened, stood close to her mother in the shade, is gone before light comes.
Lynn Lifshin.
She was transformed. After the gate opened, after she broke a little slow, she exploded. In that first race, Ruffian finished 15 lengths ahead of all the others. Her jockey never touched his whip, didn't touch her, just let her run. Her speed, supernatural, her mane, an ebony streak. Paper said the greatest race run by the first-time starter.
In your other books, you don't necessarily track a whole story exactly in this use of narrative, although you've done everything a person can do. And I'm glad. What suddenly was your belief in story as context all of a sudden, where you have become so faithful to what happened? What happened to you to make you write that way?
I think it had a lot to do with the fact that Black Sparrow had my manuscript, but they were changing hands, and I wasn't about to write another Black Sparrow-type book. And when I started thinking of horses, something magical took over.
Well, Black Sparrow has been very faithful to you.
They've been wonderful.
Wonderful through the years. And so you've made a great shift. So apparently you made an emotional shift, a career shift, and everything else, and this is evidence of that. Let's go back to Ruffian. We're at the Library of Congress. I'm Grace Cavalieri with Lynn Lifshin, one of four Washington area poets who are changing things a lot.
On the day of Ruffian's match race, it began to sprinkle after the fourth race. Everyone gasped, held their breath. 4 o'clock in the afternoon, the jockey was getting dressed. Charcoal sky at 4 o'clock. Only two jockeys. Only one could win. The air still heavy as other horses thundered past. 4 o'clock, moving toward five. In stable 34, the day began like any other. Ruffian's food tub was cleaned out. She wanted to play. It was gray. It was pewter. Ruffian lifted a foot and bowed her head. She was perfect. The doctor said so. She knew it herself. Just took one stable hand, said, at the way she stood there.
Lynn Lifshin, who is memorializing Ruffian, as if he needed it, as if she needed it. She's pretty famous.
She's very famous, and now with Barbaro, someone wrote to me just yesterday, last night, someone said, I think of Ruffian and Barbaro as bookends on the horse industry.
Are you finished with her now, with her story?
Well, I'm thinking a lot of Barbaro, and when I think of Barbaro, Ruffian keeps coming in. So it's hard to be finished with her.
Lynn is going to be coming out with Tsunami.
Yes.
From Blue Unicorn.
Right.
And I do remember the documentary film about you, Lynn Lifshin, Not Made of Glass. And there have been many, many anthologies. I think you've edited 4 women's anthologies.
Yes, I have.
So there's no such thing as overexposure, Donald Trump says.
I wonder.
And I say in poetry, I'm all for it. There is no such thing as overexposure for poetry. So keep working. And let's have another poem. Lynn Lifshin.
Ruffian. Whole and gorgeous in photographs. A beauty, 13 lengths ahead of all the fillies. How she never trailed, how she... Don't think now of that hideous July muggy thunder in the air. Think how even in her first race, May 22nd, over 30 years from this melting day, She opened up three lengths, was in front down the stretch, wild to the wire, a 15-length winner. She was cool as a jazz horn player, hardly broke a sweat. People shook their heads as if listening to Miles Davis. Think instead how she equaled the track record in her very first start, how that wasn't a fluke. Think of her beauty, massive, a giant, a gorgeous big girl. Do a riff for her perfection, feminine style, how she walked, how she could have been such a brood mare. Moan for shenanigans and ruffian sire, reviewer, with his injuries and speed, never out of the money. Blues for the match night, that black tunnel. Blues for ruffian, racing from the past and from her future.
How long did the entire manuscript take?
I started it in June of 2004, and I started sending it out in 2005. And
The whole manuscript, never single poems?
No, I never sent out any single poems. These poems have never been published except in South Carolina Review because I thought she'd be there.
Well, I have chosen a poem that I love, and I handed it to you, so I get to say that you get to read it. Is that good?
Was that?
Yeah, I'd love it. You have a final poem.
Maybe I could start with her birth and kind of start the ending with the beginning. With green blue grass holding Kentucky night water. At 9:50, April 17th, she was there suddenly, dark and slick as she would be on her last night. Ruffian, with a star on her forehead, pale buds outside the stall door. She was lying beside her mother on the straw, her mare, Shenanigans, still sweaty from the birth, though it took less than half an hour. The filly, all long, skinny legs, awkward, bent, too long, it seemed, for the little body, licorice. But when wiped down, a dark chocolate with a few gray hairs, and behind one left leg, a white band, a bracelet to go with the star she'd become.
That's Lynn Lifshin, and this is her prize-winning book, Licorice Daughter, My Year with Ruffian. Lynn Lifshin, we're at the Library of Congress. This program is produced by Forest Woods Media Productions. Associate producer is Kenneth Flynn. Post-production by Mike Turpin, MET Studios. We wish to thank the Broadcasting, Film, and Recorded Division of the Library of Congress. This is the Witter Binner series of poetry, and it's funded with assistance from the WordWorks, publishing contemporary poetry and presenting public programs in Washington, D.C. since 1975, and the Witter Binner Foundation in Poetry, supporting our 30th year on air. Our engineer is Brad McCoy. I'm Grace Cavalieri.